Welcome to the Bureau Briefing, a podcast by the Bureau of Digital, an organization devoted to giving digital professionals the support system they never had. Each episode, we're going to talk to a member of our community doing awesome, inspiring things. Now for your host, Carl Smith.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Bureau Briefing. This week, we have a very important discussion on diversity and inclusion. And I am happy to welcome to the show Lori Gold Patterson, the CEO of Pixo from Urbana, Illinois. How's it going, Lori?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. You know, we met, I believe, in San Francisco at Owner Camp 10.
Yes.
And while we were there, the conversation, we had some different parts of the day designated to talk about diversity. And it became obvious that this was a strong part of not only your education in terms of the things you've been through, but also your life. We luckily got you at Owner Summit, and you got up on stage and gave a talk that I think I know for myself, and call it out as a white male. I learned so much. I thought I was trying, but I wasn't trying. I thought I was being inclusive, but I wasn't being inclusive. So to have you here and to be able to get this message out just makes me very happy. I feel like this is the whole point of what we're doing. So if you would just give a little background and talk about your story and being a woman who's coming into technology, I think that would be a great place to start.
Absolutely. So I was one of the lone females in the mechanical engineering department at the University of Illinois when I got my degree. It's one of the top five engineering schools. And when I decided, I kind of came to knowing I wanted to be an engineer in a very strange way. It was not something growing up, you know, everyone thought I would be much more on the humanities side, but because of some different things in my life and some tragedies in my life and really trying to figure out what part of my brain I wanted to use, I got excited about doing something that I thought would be impossible, and that was going into engineering. And so I came to the University of Illinois as a transfer student, or wanted to be a transfer student, and my first experience, I had told this story at Owner Summit, one of my very first experience with the U of I was I made an appointment with the Dean of Engineering and sat down all excited and told him, you know, hey, you know, I'm a top student. I've got a, you know, year of college under me. I want to transfer here into engineering. Can you tell me all about the different types of engineering? I want to figure out which one I should register for. And he leaned back in his chair and put his feet up on his desk, and he said, "Honey, have you considered home economics?" So, rightfully so, he was responding to the fact that I was very ill prepared. I did not have mentors in my life or anybody who had prepared me for going into this field or going or even deciding to be an engineer. So I showed up across the table from him as someone who in no way looked like I could be a successful candidate. So I really do, you know, I acknowledge that 100%. But he was not trained how to dive in and see folks who might come to a desire to pursue engineering that come from really different angles. And so, you know, he could have asked me some questions and would have found out very quickly how driven I was, how prepared I was, you know, that I didn't know how to say the right things, but that I had really put my ducks in a row. So that was kind of the first, in terms of my own education and my own career, I'm in IT. I've been, you know, the only or one of very few women at most of the tables in my career, and I have adored it. But I've definitely had been able to come from a point of view and a perspective to see that there are environments that are not inclusive at all. So on the other side, I have kind of a unique background in that my my family came from East LA and came to the Midwest, to the University of Illinois, when I was just a baby, for my dad to get his doctorate. And I was raised, my parents were activists, and I was raised, in civil rights marches and in the basement of wonderful black churches as they were planning these marches. And so most of my childhood was really, I was raised more in the African-American community and really enmeshed in a much more diverse upbringing than, most white people or Jewish people in my community. So that certainly brought a perspective for me. And my husband is African-American, and he and I, we have three wonderful biracial children who we're now helping them in their phase of navigating being underrepresented in their education and in their careers. So it's really the two things, having, professionally experienced through education and professionally experienced being exceptionally underrepresented in my field. And since I was very young, being raised in a very cultural environment that brings my passion to this topic.
And you're a CEO of a digital agency. I mean, you're doing software, you're doing all kinds of different things. You've got the engineering background, but even as a CEO, you've caught yourself when you're going through the hiring practice, maybe not being as open to diversity as you could be, right?
Well, absolutely. So, I have always held our company, Pixo, to the highest standards of having women in programming and development positions, in having African-Americans and Hispanics and any underrepresented professionals in the company. And yet we've struggled. I mean, we have, there was one time I think we had three female developers. We have one now out of, I think our development team is 14. We have, I think, four African-American professionals here, technical professionals here. So no, we do not, I've not been satisfied at all. And so I've investigated a lot. I've put a lot of time into trying to figure out what it is that causes both myself, when I'm so passionate about working in an environment that has a very inclusive and diverse benefit, why I haven't been able to achieve that as nearly as well as I've wanted to for our company. And I think a lot of it comes from biases that we don't even know exist, for example, some years ago, I realized that, I was raised, professionally in a time when we were all taught that if a resume had even one typo on it, you put it in the trash pile, because that tells you that, that the person doesn't pay attention to detail. And being taught other things to look for on a resume so that you limit it to just the top candidates. But what I realize is that our biases come across as we look at resumes. And even the fact, for me, if I see a female name, I'm all over it. I'm all excited. where someone else who, is not used to or does not have an experience with working with technical females may see a female name and feel a little fuzzy, like, oh gosh, I'm not sure that that's right for my organization. So we bring a lot of biases into even just this piece, looking at the piece of paper. And I had to reteach myself how to read resumes so that I would not be bringing those biases to the table.
And so I think that's such amazing advice. I know running Engine for 14 years and hired a lot of people that look like me. Mm-hmm. And, one of my original partners, Varick, is Filipino. That was, I guess we could go, hey, we're diverse, but we weren't. And then as we got larger, there was a call. The team wanted more female developers. And this was interesting, because then you have this thing of, well, I want to make sure we get the best people. So it's really about the applicants. Is one of the things that I walked away with. We've got to get more diverse applicants. And you gave advice that basically – if you want more diversity, first of all, you ask the people who are diverse, where can we find more people that are diverse? And secondly, this word inclusion,
right,
that it's not enough to bring in people who are different. It is important that they get to be integrated, that they get to use their brains and their backgrounds and everything that makes them them. So you shared a story about kale that sticks with me and is the example that I use today when I'm trying to explain to people. Share that with everybody listening.
I will, and I will tell you that, so that was a pretty new analogy that I had come to, and I will tell the analogy, but since then I've been sitting with it, and there's some part of it that's a little sour to me. So maybe you can tell me. There's a part that I realized I did not get quite right. So the story is that, all of us, healthy eaters have been eating salads and, using romaine lettuce and baby greens for years, right? And we create these wonderful salads with the lettuce that we're used to. And then a number of years ago, all of a sudden, kale came on the market. People started talking about kale. And so I remember going to the store and looking at the kale and feeling it, and it was just like it was too firm, it was too dry, and like there was no way I would know how to make a salad out of this. So I didn't. And then some time went by, and colleagues of mine started showing up at work with wonderful leftovers from the night before, with meals of kale. Like, kale was just in everything. And so I said, all right, I've got to figure out this kale thing. Everybody's talking about how good it is for your health, and how it can, broaden, your meals. So I went to the store and I said, I'm buying some kale. And I forced myself to buy the kale, and I put it into my refrigerator, and then my refrigerator was diverse. At that point, I had kale, I had romaine, and I have a diverse refrigerator. And then the kale went moldy because I didn't know how to use it. So over time, I decided, no, I really have got to figure out how to integrate this into our meal plan. And I studied, I figured, I found recipes, folks who had good smelling stuff at work, I asked them for the recipes, and I started using kale and getting used to it, and it became a regular part of ingredient in our meals. And now we buy, we don't even think about it when we go to the store. We just, we have kale, we have other things, and it's all part of our food, and now our meals are diverse. The part of it that I'm feeling a little sour about, and I've got to figure out, is that in that analogy, the kale itself couldn't really do anything but sit in the refrigerator until I decided to do something with it. And that misses a huge point about inclusion. That in fact, in our organizations, in particular us as leaders, we have to figure out how to get the hell out of the way and embrace the change that we start seeing happen. We don't have to be so comfortable with everything that starts developing in the culture in our organization. Same thing, probably many folks listening to this do have some experience with millennials coming into their organization, right? And we're all trying to figure out, as middle-aged business people, who are these millennials? What is this all about? And part of really integrating people of different generations into your organization is being willing to learn from them and change and adapt to their culture, not have them adapt to your culture. So there's a part of the analogy of kale. Kale's not quite doing its job to the fullest extent.
Right. That importance that, as somebody who is running and possibly founded an organization, your culture is going to change, mm-hmm. and you have to be okay with that. Because to that analogy, even with the sour part, or because of the sour part, if you don't allow your culture to change, right, they're not going to be as included as they could be. And you're going to miss out on such a benefit, because the business side from the Harvard Business Review and all of these types of things talking about the benefits of diversity.
So, right.
That to me is amazing as well. And you shared a story about a young woman who was working at a company and her boss, and the young woman was, I believe she was Black, and I can't really remember the story now. I'm totally baffling this. I'm going to delete this. What was the story?
I'm trying to think of what
they were talking about. Basically you know what? I have not messed up a podcast in so long.
You're good.
Oh man. I'm just nervous. I really am.
It's
so funny.
So let's talk a little bit about, so our listeners are not going to hear a little part that you just took out because you were botching a question you were asking me. And the reason why you said you were botching is because you're nervous. And you're nervous because when we talk about diversity and inclusion, in particular, white men get nervous.
Yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense. Right now, you think of yourself as somebody who really cares, right? You want to get this stuff right. And, right?
Guilty as charged.
I'm going to back up a minute. It was interesting at the presentation at Owner Summit. After I got done, one question got asked, and then a gentleman stood up and he said, "You would think after a talk like that, every hand in the place would go up. But the reason why we're not putting our hands up is because we're all nervous that we're going to say something wrong, even though we have so many questions." So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So when he did that, and I'll tell you, as somebody who was organizing the event, and he asked that question, my heart stopped. Because not only because I was nervous and not because I was an organizer, although I felt I had a lot invested in the event, but because there was a truth to it. And I didn't want to look at that truth. It's one of those things as a white male, when you think you're trying and then you find out you're not really. And then there is, this potential for this backlash. And my roots are Mississippi, right? That's where my parents were raised. And I've met my grandparents, it was a while ago, but there's a lot of tension there. So when he made the comment that the hands aren't going up because we're nervous, that rang true. And even
was the best question. I said that deserved the ovation because for him to get up and say that's how everybody feels. Absolutely everybody feels. And so he was asking for advice, right? On what do we do when he said that he has an organization that is somewhat diverse and he wants to talk about it. He wants to promote it and really, expand it. But he said he's uncomfortable talking about it at home. He's uncomfortable talking about it at work. And my advice really is that vulnerability is so important in every part of how we run our businesses, every part of how we run our lives. And to be the person who says, "Hey, listen," to a room full of colleagues that maybe have, two people who are underrepresented and all white people, it doesn't matter who you're talking to, but to say, "Hey, listen, it matters to me that we get this right. It matters to me that we become an inclusive environment where down the road we don't even remember what it was like not to be inclusive. But in doing that, I know that I don't have the perspective and the experience to know what it's right and wrong to say, how I come off. And I need you all, in particular, the folks who are underrepresented, I need you to pull my chain. I need you to be honest with me, but also not to just put me in a box. If I say something that is offensive, I need to trust that at least the first time, you're going to trust that I'm coming from a position of ignorance, not hate or not, purposeful bias, and you'll check me on it and give me what I need to understand what I've done. Then if you don't see that I get my act together, you don't have to trust that again. But I do need you to trust me at least the first time so that we can start to break down these barriers and I can learn.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. And even earlier in the show, and it wasn't anything, you know, I'm happy to share it with people, but it was one of those things where I was filtering myself. Mm-hmm. I was like trying to make sure, I was like, do I say African-American or do I say black? Right. And there are these little things. And so to your point, yeah, it's about giving ourselves permission on any side of the conversation to be okay with the way the conversation goes, so long as we're allowed to say, hey, let me explain how that felt.
Right.
And right. Not have to feel like we're filtering ourselves because that's uncomfortable and it sets us up to fail. Right.
Absolutely. But then we have to recognize that, you know, we're particularly talking about diversity and inclusion in small to medium sized businesses, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're talking from an owner perspective and we're mostly speaking to owners, right? And so we have to be really cognizant that the dynamics are also a hierarchical dynamic where typically in these conversations, in these situations, we have power over the individuals that we're affecting. And that makes this all the more complicated.
Yeah. And right now my brain is just flying through so many things. When we go through, and this was something that came up in a conversation, and we start looking at the way we present ourselves, right? I mean, with websites, with the way that we post a job posting, with anything like that, that's really the beginning of the conversation. And I used to tell people all the time, whatever somebody finds first, that's the beginning of a promise. And when they finally meet you, that's either the fulfillment of the promise or a surprise. That was not what I expected. And thinking about things like Instagram and thinking about things like, you know, companies, small companies are constantly showing themselves out at lunch or their website where you see the photos and they're all the same. They're mm-hmm. all the same person in different places or, you know, there may be some gender diversity. I think that's the one that seems to be the first step. But that sets the tone for everything.
Right.
And
so one of the things I wanted us to hit on is that in business, we don't typically start to see real change until there is a business reason, a financial drive,
right,
for that change. And, you know, we might have really good hearts and we want to do this and we know this is better, you know, this would be nice to do or better for our society. But it's really hard to see sustainable change happening until there's real business drivers. So one of the things that I'm most excited about right now are studies that are coming out showing that millennials of all backgrounds, that means white male millennials as well as everybody else, they're a generation that expects inclusive environments. They are looking for companies that will expose them to the things that they have been exposed to in social media. So even individuals who come from rural places or places that don't have a lot of physical diversity and exposure, because they are so exposed on media, they're looking to move into their adulthood and experience the vibrancy that they know the world to be now. And so as business owners, if we have sameness, if we have environments that are not diverse and not inclusive, that's actually a silent killer that we don't even really know exists yet. And in a very short period of time, white male owners of small businesses are going to find themselves not knowing why they can't attract the talent that they need to attract. And I fear that if if we don't learn fast enough, we're going to see a lot of devastation in not being able to maintain competitiveness. So I'm actually excited about that, because that means this is not a benevolent conversation we're having here.
Right.
This is a business conversation we're having.
And right. And, you know, I had a conversation with my 12-year-old this morning, and you know, to the point of, I mean, millennials and now digital natives and all of this, hopefully it won't flip back. Right. I think it's here to stay. And I was just asking, I was like, what do you think of the presidential candidates? And she told me she liked Bernie. And mm-hmm. I said, why? She goes, I just love his record on LGBT.
It's
my 12-year-old. I was like, okay, good to know. So I think that reinforces your point that it goes even past the millennials, right? There's going to be an expectation across, I would hope, a majority.
Well, so my children, as I said, they're Jewish, they're African American, and they were raised in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. And I remember when my daughter she's now 22, but when she was, I think maybe a sophomore in college or in high school, she came home and she was talking about an organization. She had gone to a meeting after school, and it was some organization that she had just joined. And I asked her what it was, and it was the LGBT organization.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she affiliates or self-describes as being, you know, heterosexual.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember just thinking to myself how there's so many areas of diversity that she's living in her life, right? She was part of the African American Club also at school. But it just really resonated with me that she made sure to be involved in an organization that didn't affect her personally, but was an area that she felt was getting the least attention in terms of diversity. Hmm. And she was exceptionally passionate about. And it just really opened my eyes that this generation is very different. They're just, I don't think it's compassion. I think it's expectation.
There you go. Yeah. I think that's, for my kids who are 12 and 14, I think that's it. They just can't understand why it wouldn't be
exactly
that way. It's like it makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So for people who are out there right now listening who do have their own shops, or maybe they're thinking about growing their shops, what advice would you give them in terms of putting together a diversity plan? Is one of those phrases that seems to catch different people different ways. How would you say they should act, or how would you say they should move forward in trying to increase the diversity and inclusion in their shops?
So there's several things. I mean, one of them is to, one is to recognize that it is a competitive requirement, right? Because we learn more, we stay paying attention, and we move forward when we understand that it's a competitive advantage or a competitive requirement. So first is just to get your head right? Understand again that that we're not talking about benevolence. Then we need to get ourselves spending time in places where there are people that are not like us. So, you know, look around your community. Start going to places that you haven't frequented before, that are out of your comfort zone. Get to know people, preferably professional people, you know, that may also own companies, or that are, you know, have other things that you have similarities with. But identify if there's some organizations that either cater to African Americans, for example, or women in technology, or, you know, any group that you are really feeling that you need to bring in terms of the inclusiveness in your company, and start to get to know people and be honest with them. Hey, listen, I'm a local business owner. I don't have a lot of opportunities to hire, but when I do, I am placing a high value on ensuring that I discontinue hiring exactly who is like me and I need help. And just, you know, start some relationships. Another suggestion is, we talked about this at Owner Summit, another suggestion is to consider putting together an advisory board, maybe a, if you don't already have a general advisory board, this is a great time to do it. If you do have a general advisory board, look at who's on your advisory board and figure out how to diversify it. And the reason is that many of us, when we're looking to start to diversify our company, we open up an internship or a junior position. And then we've introduced yet another hurdle for the individual who's unrepresented in the company. Not only do they look different, are their norms potentially different, did they come from different environment, but they're also now the least experienced, least respected person in the organization. And so I really recommend trying to figure out how to diversify from the top down. So pulling together an advisory board that can come in and, you know, spend some time in your company, sit in some meetings, point out little idiosyncratic parts of your culture that might really not feel small and idiosyncratic at all to an individual who is unrepresented in your company. Or, if at all possible, hire into a senior position, a managerial position.
That's great advice. And I think one word that stuck out for me was let them know you want to discontinue and acknowledge that we're here right now because of what I've done, you know, the way that I've pretty much hired, and now I'm ready to make this change. And the idea of that advisory board or advisory council and having them come in, that's why your middle name's Gold.
Thank you.
Lori, thank you so much for being on the Bureau Briefing today. I truly appreciate it. And I'm glad everyone got to listen in and get this great advice.
Absolutely. My pleasure. We have a long way to go.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week with another episode. Have a great week.